That's beautiful.
Finding a way to get
on the ground, knocked down by Vargas. Here comes Wagaman. No throw. Ball game. The Angels win it in the 13th inning. The final 4-3. And Angels will take this series 2-1.
If that one sticks in the glove, the Angels are not going to be able to score. Unfortunately, it does not. And that is that.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Yeah, the Sox lost another game, David. It was they lasted a long time in that one.
They did.
They did lose yet another game.
They lose another game.
And they're three losses away from matching the worst record ever. There are 11 games
left? No, there are 9 games left. They're 36-117, three shy of tying the 1962 Mets for the most losses in a season.
Four shy of breaking a new record.
Yeah, it's the magic number, or the tragic number, if you will.
Sure.
So they are on the verge of making the wrong kind of history. Meanwhile, the national media, obviously because this is a historic event, are trying to address it and cover it. We talked about the Jeff Passan story on ESPN.com yesterday. He spent 24 hours with the 24 White Sox. Today, something much more damning. And to me, something much more definitive. In The Athletic, a tremendous piece of sports journalism, Brittany Garoli and Ken Rosenthal talked to at least 40 former White Sox or current White Sox employees, people that are around the team, talked to 40 people for this story, well-reported, well-sourced, and it is a takedown. It is a takedown in many different ways, and it's not meant to be a hit piece, but it does explore exactly what's at the root of the problem. And what's at the root of the problem, in their view, the conclusion is, it's in the headline, it's the way it's presented, that Jerry Reinsdorf is way too frugal to survive in today's modern sports landscape.
And reading it, he's way too influential on what the White Sox are doing. And Jerry is, he responded at one point about analytics, saying there's a place for it in baseball, but basically it's not the lead item.
Well, that is one area, too. There's one of several. Let's talk about that one for a second.
Yes.
Tommy Pham was one of the players on the record who talked about the defensive metrics not being what they are at other places. It also includes the detail that the Sox have outsourced their analytics research, and they don't have it as quickly at their disposal or as readily available as other teams. They're not keeping up in the arms race analytically. And that's a problem. And I think that is that's under the umbrella of trying to what? Cut costs. So the frugality of the owner is the consistent theme throughout. The lead is fantastic. The lead serves as an introduction to what you're going to read after it. And it addresses the fact that the White Sox still travel on an Airbus 320, a type of plane that was manufactured in the 80s. 8 first-class seats, the rest coach. And it says, as one player mocked it getting on board this year, no show plane? The White Sox travel in a way that is representative of the way they play and the way that they approach business, the business of baseball. They try to cut costs, they cut corners, and you get what you pay for.
They get into so much in this story, and they talk so much about basically Jerry's influence on the team in a very real fashion, and sort of the warring elements within the organization that led them to the point they're at now. And I got to tell you, David, as you read this story and you contemplate where this team is at right now, I mean, you got an 88-year-old owner that is operating as if it's still 1992, and he has as the story points out, has his own beliefs and is mired in them and won't let the team grow in the fashion in which it has to. He's far too influential and far too restricting in terms of what they can eventually do because he won't invest in it because he doesn't believe in it. I'm talking about analytics. I'm talking about whether it's team travel, players, whatever you want to call
it. That's a lack of financial investment, but he does still keep his hand in the cookie jar, if you will. He still is meddling.
He's a guy who thinks he knows everything.
And it goes back to, and this traces a...
And might have in 1992.
The rift between Kenny Williams and Rick Hahn is traced back to pre-2020 when Kenny announced at one of the meetings that he was going to get more involved, according to the story. One source says that compared it to the Michael Jordan unretirement. All of a sudden, Kenny was back. And he was back to put his stamp on a franchise he felt like was getting away from him, the way it's described, the way it's depicted. It also described how Kenny Williams wanted to elevate his son in the organization. Meanwhile, Rick Hahn wanted to trust Jeremy Haber, a fellow Harvard graduate, I believe.
Yeah.
No longer part of the organization, I don't think. So that began sort of this divide organizationally, which created a friction that was difficult to overcome. Mully, I think, though, the part where is really interesting to me, it's all very interesting to me, was, as you allude to, Jerry Reinsdorf again getting back involved and hijacking the process when they hired Tony La Russa.
Yes.
The press release including the A.J. Hinch signature.
Well, we knew that.
A.J. Hinch getting planning to be in Chicago. But this is what's interesting now. What is it? Nearly 3 years later, Kenny Williams, who went on the record to his credit for this story, said this about that time. Quote, "I don't yet have a way to talk about that period of time because it takes me to a bad place and it will take me from the person I aspire to be." End of quote.
It's amazing that they got him on the record. And frankly, it's amazing he said that because, you know, he's very complimentary to Jerry. He talks about Jerry's willingness to spend and other things like that. But I've got to tell you, you know, this situation, the White Sox current dilemma has gotten utterly and completely out of control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had a chance to go outside the organization and bring someone in, and you promoted from within, telling people that you did so because it was going to make you better faster. They lost 101 games a year ago. They're about to lose over 126. How many are they going to lose? I mean, that might be a modest way of looking at it.
Nine left, and they've already lost 117. I don't know if they're going to lose every game, but they could be close to 123, 124 losses.
Could be more like 125, 126.
Okay. I'm not going to quibble. I'm not quibbling.
They're putting the record out of reach.
Yes, they are.
And they're doing so because the guy in charge of it thinks he knows more than anyone else. He's 88 years old. He's still calling the shots. He's got an office that opens into the baseball operations department, and he's influential on everything they do. And guess what? It's not working.
Huh?
Yeah.
Perhaps the most damning quote in the entire story is the last one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story full of damning quotes, so consider that. One former player, anonymous, but I understand why, says this, quote, "The rumor was always we will never figure it out until ownership changes. That's the real thing holding it back. The real thing holding it back isn't the people and player development. It is the owner." End of quote. Former player, echoing what a lot of people believe, who cover the team, who are season ticket holders, who are loyal fans like yourself, people who have lived and died with the White Sox over the years, are fed up. And as I said, there have been other stories. I'm not sure there's one that is quite as damning and one that the Sox can't ignore. This is not something that you can ignore in today's climate. I just don't think you can. I don't know what effect it will have.
I mean, here's the problem, though, David. Do you think that Jerry Reinsdorf read this story? Do you think he just wanted to know what the quotes were, highlight who said what about me? Or do you think that he read it with an open mind and thought, this is interesting. Maybe I am kind of... I don't think...
Because of the distance between Jerry Reinsdorf and the people who cover him, at least us, I know there's some people who are close to him. I don't consider myself one of them. I couldn't tell you what he's thinking because I don't know him that well. I would presume that he wants to ignore this and just have somebody tell him what the worst part of it is and how he was quoted and represented. I don't know if there's anybody in that organization that will tell him how bad this actually is or has gotten.
You know, we talked about it earlier this year, and it wasn't that long ago, maybe a month ago, CBS Sports did a story that was kind of a hatchet job on Jerry. And I was saying to you that in the old days, Jerry would have gone after that. He would have gone after that reporter. He would have made it kind of his mission to punish someone that had that had done something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, because he has. Yeah.
He's done that before.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that he is either, I don't know how connected to stuff he is anymore, how much he cares about it anymore, or how much, I mean, would he even pick up the phone and call The Athletic and say, hey, that was wrong?
Well, he did cooperate in terms of, I think, exchanging emails. So yeah. I think he was aware of this story. And I do not want to diminish anything about the previous story that we addressed briefly but didn't spend a lot of time on. I felt like the differences, and not to, again, not to quibble, but that read more like a research paper encompassing all of the failures that the White Sox have had,
right,
and making some presumptions.
And
this
here are some old stories that were out, and here's some quotes.
That was
from
a compilation.
I got you.
This feels more like new information, freshly reported.
40 people with the organization interview.
This is complete.
This is a more complete look at the failure, and it is an utter failure. And I mean, did it begin with hiring Tony La Russa? That seems to be one of the conclusions in the story. I don't know that. I think that they were probably on the wrong track if they weren't using the correct data, if they had two different sources of data, if there was a conflict in the actual information that they were sharing with people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, clearly this has been an awful sort of result as you've gone through different methods of trying to build a team. And the data problem is sort of like Kenny and Rick. There's a similarity with different people running the thing as opposed to different sources of information that you use.
And yet that tension was creative tension that did not necessarily get in the way, you could argue, until Tony La Russa was hired, and I feel like that was the beginning of the end. I feel like up until that point, maybe the Sox, well, let's go back and remember, this was one of the most exciting young teams in baseball when Tim Anderson, it wasn't that long ago.
I know.
And so what my point in bringing that up is the Sox kind of convinced themselves that the way they were doing this, the way they were getting by frugally, economically feasible, that was working. Because they had all these young, exciting players that they were changing the game with Tim Anderson and Jose Abreu and all these things. So, Mully, I think that they were kidding themselves at that point. But then they hired Tony La Russa, and then the rift was exposed.
And that's fine. And then they, you know, we know what happened. Miguel Cairo took over because Tony got ill, and then you brought in Pedro Grifol, and, you know, you didn't go outside the organization to get a general manager. We understand everything that happened, but now we look at this organization. They've lost 100 games. Now they're losing. They're going to set a record for the most losses. They announced last week that they're not investing in this team, that there will be no spending via free agency.
And cutting costs in 2025.
They're going to try to trim payroll, yeah. And that's kind of what they're going to – I mean, so how many games are they planning to lose? And again, you're talking about
100
at least, right?
100.
They're going for a third
year.
Well, I
think that's a good place to start. That's the bar.
But I think it could be closer. I mean, maybe next year they tie the 120.
It's kind of like being a millionaire. Once you lose 100 games, what's the difference between 100 and 110? I don't know.
Yeah.
You're still going to be one of the worst teams in baseball.
So like when you look at them and you look at the roster and you look at the talent level, do you ask yourself, when are they not going to lose 100 games? Like, how long will it take them to not lose 100, let alone actually contend?
Well, in the interest,
they haven't even hit rock bottom
yet. In the interest of fairness, that Jerry Reinsdorf did speak to The Athletic. He's on the record addressing your very question, the timeline. Jerry says, quote, "No one can project a timeline to winning, but there are many examples of organizations, some very recently, like Kansas City and Baltimore, that have rebounded very quickly," end of quote.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's the other thing, though. You know, they don't believe in analytics like, you know, they use Houston and Tampa. different organizations that have used analytics to help them to either get out of the mire or to stay at a high level once they have. And they don't even know. They're giving contrary information to players. They're flying in their 1992 plane or 1988, whatever it
no,
is.
No, I know.
I'm just saying,
I know,
David,
what you're saying.
No, it's beyond frustrating.
It's got to be, and I understand that. I think that also you know, we've done this and long enough to understand the way stories are put together and presented. Essentially, what the Athletic is doing in using these anecdotes and choosing these images, they are presenting to their audience, to Major League Baseball, the White Sox are a cheap organization.
Yes, they are.
And they're not going to win until they change that.
Yeah, but they're not cheap in the way that we talk about cheap. They're not investing behind the scenes in anything.
They go to great lengths to make that point clear.
Yes.
Because of the way they travel, because of the way they research, yes. And that also affects, in their minds, the way they play. They don't say that overtly, but the way they present the images in the reporting makes it very clear that that's a conclusion that they reach. You're not going to change your winning ways or your losing ways until you commit to investing or reinvesting into the organization in a meaningful way, the way other teams do, the way winning franchises do.
For now, as his franchise craters, Reinsdorf continues to conduct business in his preferred style, operating out of his suite, surrounded by old friends and memorabilia.
Yes, people who typically aren't going to tell him how bad this has gotten and how terrible this looks.
312-644-6767. John is in Fox Lake. Hey, John.
Hey, guys. You kind of touched upon it. I guess I have a two-part question. So the 62 Mets, they only played 160 games, so they were 40-120. The Sox have to play the Padres in San Diego, the Angels at home, and they finish out with Detroit. I don't know if they're going to have more than 40 wins, to be honest with you. I don't know what you guys think. Second part, have we hit rock bottom? Because I don't think so. I think 25 will be rock bottom for the Sox in terms of it all falling apart internally. Mm-hmm. And lastly, just one last thing. I've never forgiven Reinsdorf for 94. That was a hot Sox team that I felt was going to go all the way. And Reinsdorf was the ringleader behind that strike year. And, you know, the guy only got lucky with the Bulls because of Michael Jordan. Outside of that, this guy's been nothing but the worst owner in sports. That's an emotional take, but it is the way I feel. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, John. Appreciate the phone call. A lot of people feeling emotional about the White Sox this morning. And as far as rock bottom, one can hope that this season represents rock bottom. Every time I say they're going to lose 100 games next year, you correct me, and you're right. In doing so, it might be worse.
Yes.
It could get worse.
It feels like it's only going to get worse.
I also want to point out this about the timeline, and I mentioned the Royals, and we know what the Twins are capable of doing.
Yeah.
Look at the Tigers. The White Sox are in a very difficult division that's gotten better in a hurry. The Tigers, on August 10th, this is according to Optostats, 55-63 on August 10th. They're now 80-73. Half game out of a playoff spot.
Wow.
Tigers, Royals, Twins. Those are teams. Oh, they're chasing who? The Guardians. That division is suddenly very, very good.
Yeah, I don't think that has any relevance to why the Sox are as god-awful as they are. I'm not arguing it. You're absolutely right. I'm just saying, you know, they no longer have the imbalanced schedule. They no longer – the Sox have lost to everyone.
Absolutely true. But it is an irrelevant tidbit that tells you how far they have to go.
That's fair. I'm not arguing it. I'm just saying. 312-644-6767.
You sound like Chelly.
Yeah. White Sox. Mully and Haw on the score.
Going down to the home stretch of the season, just thoughts on the team. Trying to avoid history. How much is that on the mind of
people? Like I've been telling everyone, yeah, we get the same question every day. You know, we're focused on just one series at a time, one game at a time. You know, everything else is irrelevant right now. You know, we're just trying to get better and win games.
Mulligan Hall, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. That is Grady Sizemore. He is the current manager, the interim manager.
Interim?
He took over when they finally relieved themselves of Pedro Grifol.
Pedro Grifol was fired. He also spoke to The Athletic. First time he's spoken publicly about his time with the White Sox. So I want to ask you this.
Sure.
We talked about the Athletic story this morning, was dropped. People should read because it's a real exhaustive look at what's wrong with the White Sox. Yesterday, Jeff Passan posted a story on ESPN.com, or maybe it was the night before, 24 hours with the White Sox.
Mm-hmm.
He presented Grady Sizemore very favorably and suggested that he would be a serious candidate for the manager's job next season when they are expected to lose at least 100 games.
Yeah. Well,
what do you think?
I think that's great. I think that's wonderful. I thought the Jeff Passan story was complimentary. I think that he wrote a nice story about the White Sox.
He did, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. After reading what they did in The Athletic, if you're Jeff, do you regret that you got out in front of that story?
And you painted such a positive picture about players who were – you humanized them in a clubhouse.
Tough players.
Guys who were playing for their major league careers and lives through all of the negativity that's
– What negativity?
Negativity. It's tough to go to the ballpark every day knowing you're going to lose.
Oh, but the negativity – I mean, there's not anyone there booing them.
That's true. There's nobody there.
They've driven all the fans away.
There's nobody there.
Because they know they get paid no
so matter
what.
So wait, we both were sports writers. We've both been in this situation.
Yes.
So do you feel like after doing something, a story you might feel very good about, and I think that Jeff Passan wrote that very well, introduced some different ideas. He wrote it very well. But the angle was totally different than what we read today. How would you feel in that situation having written that and then seeing what comes after that?
Well, I honest to God, if I woke up this morning and I got a newspaper, let's say, and I read a story that was completely opposite the one that I wrote and was very well researched, and there'd be like a spitting out of the coffee as I stared at my rote.
Rotating
digital phone.
Just checking if my instincts are still intact.
Waiting for the office to call and tell me what a loser I was. And how could I get my arse kicked as badly as I did? That's the phone call you would get if you. And I don't know because I never really lost on a story. See what I did there?
What you did there. But I know better.
My stomach would drop and I'd feel awful. Like am I part of the problem?
I appreciated the way that he presented the human side of the players involved yesterday on the ESPN.com story.
Right.
But I also think that what you just said is valid, and there are two different franchises or two different situations if you look at the both stories independently. And I don't know that you would feel very good about that necessarily, even though it was well written and researched. What the Athletic chronicled today is something that is going to leave a mark in terms of you're going to remember things that were said. The Kenny Williams stuff is very damning and very interesting. And I just feel like you're the Sox and you're at I don't even say you're at a crossroads. This is just takes you deeper into the abyss.
Yeah. No, you have lost your way. You are now wandering through the woods without a compass. You don't know how to get back to civilization. And you are lost, abandoned. No one's looking for you. I mean, I'm just saying.
It's going to take you more to find your way than getting on a river cruise and going by the 78 and showing people who are politicians how cool this could look and refurbishing the diamond with Roger Bossert's help to kind of give you a replica of what you want to build there. Ozzie Guillen, we talked to him yesterday when you were out, Molly. He described a great time on Monday, a great presentation by the White Sox. The only problem is, with related Midwest as the backdrop and willing to put up a lot of their own money to develop that land and that neighborhood, it remains a taxpayer burden if you do that, and nobody's quite clear about the details, and that is something that Ozzie couldn't really get into.
Yeah.
He had a great time with Ron Kittle. Bo Jackson was on the cruise. Bo Jackson was there. Bo knows South Loop.
I was out yesterday, as you mentioned. I had a colonoscopy. Frankly, I'd rather endure that I'd rather spend the time with that stuff you got to drink and all that than go try to be positive about what's going on. Okay?
I'm not forcing you to do that.
I'm just saying.
I'm just going over the week that was, that is.
Yeah.
So on Monday, they had the River Cruise pointing out, you know, where their vision of a new ballpark.
Yes, and I would prefer a colonoscopy to that. Okay. And it wasn't the most pleasant experience I've had in my life. You know, honestly, the prep of it is horrible. The actual colonoscopy was great, very professional. It was run very well, and I appreciated.
Did you give him your pep talk?
I didn't.
Did you give him the pep talk?
I told you what happened. My first one, yeah. I did pop up and give everyone like a pep talk because they were kind of chatting away, and they thought I was already knocked out. This time? I like got hit with, we're going to give you a little bit of, and then I was awakened and told it was over. And I was literally like, what?
That's the best kind of colonoscopy.
A minute ago, I was just talking to someone. So it was it was wonderful. Now, the whole day I was walking around like a Sox fan, just in a complete fog, unsure of what had happened and how it had gotten to this point. Like a Sox fan. Jeff is in Kalamazoo. Hey, Jeff.
Good morning, gentlemen. While we're talking about colonoscopies, let's just say the White Sox need an enema. My dream was that the last game of the homestand was going to be the 121st loss, or the chance for the 121st loss. And I was dreaming of a demolition derby style takeover of the field where they have to forfeit for the 121st loss, but I don't want people to go to jail for Jerry, so that's a horrible thought. But what if we filled that stadium 35,000 strong on that day, and then every section starting after the fifth inning started the chant sell the team and started emptying the park out section by section with everybody chanting sell the team till everybody was gone by the sixth or seventh inning. That's where I'm at with the White Sox right about now.
Yeah, it's fair, Jeff. I don't think that will happen because I don't know that people want to turn up. I don't know that anybody wants to
be bothered at this point.
Yeah, I think there has seemingly been a conscious effort to keep people from turning up. Maybe in order to keep the state paying and then emphasizing that you need to build a new stadium since you're paying so much for this one. I don't know what it is.
You wonder really about...
I don't know what the idea is.
Bob Nightingale reported over the weekend, I think, that the 2025 quest will be to cut costs.
Yeah, that's great.
And already... And you know, Molly, we talk about the Milwaukee Brewers who celebrated last night their NL Central Division title, third and fourth years. They know how to win. They have an organizational mission. They have... everything in place. They have the right infrastructure. They have a small market team that is winning in a big way every year. They're 21st in payroll, the Brewers. The White Sox, the White Sox staring at another third straight 100-loss season next year, at least 100.
Yeah, I mean, we're being positive.
So they have $121 million, I'm sorry, $133 million payroll. Yep. They're 18th in the league.
Yeah, but I got no sympathy for a team that's paying the wrong guys.
I'm not asking you to have sympathy. I guess what I'm doing is pointing out that
you can win with that payroll.
That's
what they want to
prove. You can. They want to prove that. But what the Athletic story reveals are all the obstacles in the way of doing business the right way and getting back to the point where you can have some credibility. What that story did today was it just was in a long season of things that are undercutting the credibility of the White Sox.
Well, I mean, what that story did today was point out the lack of credibility that the owner has, both in the way he spends money, in his attitude toward the game of baseball, his old-fashioned view of things. He's trapped in a different era than the current one. And I think that is basically what they attempt to prove within this story, or that's what's been revealed from their report.
There's no doubt about that. The outsourcing of the analytics is one of the more damning details involved.
Agreed.
And when they say that, you know, a former player, even though Tommy Pham is controversial in his own way.
He was a hell of a player.
He was pretty good White Sox player, and he's talking about the limitations that the White Sox have as a team because players don't have the same access to the same information that players on other teams do. And if anybody might know that, it might be a guy who is as well traveled as Tommy Pham is.
I had no problem with anything he said. I thought he was being, you know, fair with the way he viewed things, and that he also pointed out that they were getting false information, bad information, and the analytics were not up to snuff. He said, that's a huge area I felt could be better. He said, they know it. He basically said that the White Sox are still untangling the lines of communication, and that several former members of the team pointed out that defensive positioning is an area of concern. The Sox rank near or at the bottom of publicly available defensive metrics, in part, former players say, because their fielders are often in the wrong spots.
To reduce the cost of overhead, the team outsourced some number crunching to Zalus Analytics, a private outside firm. You just can't do that and expect to compete and contend and keep pace with teams that are passing you in your division and have already passed you, and let alone teams in the American League that you're contending with for a pennant. That seems so far away.
If I am Zalus Analytics, I would want to keep my name away from being associated with the White Sox, right? I don't want to use them. Hey, you want to set a record for the most losses ever?
Yes.
We've got the information.
I don't
see what I'm saying?
And yeah,
it's not
I do see what you're saying. I would not even stand in line for a campfire milkshake if I were working for Zalus Analytics.
Now you're going to get to a Brandon. He's getting angry because he really does believe that that's the best thing.
I think he means we have to take a break. He's not waving his fist.
I thought he was shaking his fist at
me. He's saying we have to break.
Okay.
He might be shaking his fist at me.
Yeah.
You have already today.
Damn you, Hawk.
See?
You have spent a lot of time kind of ruining my life today.
Today I have.
In a good day.
I'm baiting you.
I think you're just angry that I wasn't here for you to ruin yesterday.
I am. I'm still mad about that.
You saved up.
I am.
Yeah.
I'm very resentful.
Yeah. I had,
had a colonoscopy and I didn't.
Yes. Damn you. You've gotten that undigested burger for 7 years ago removed.
Stop.
I'm still dealing with it.
Please break.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670.
Nick Costos next.
I want winners.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670. The Score. On the line is the host of You Better You Bet, Odyssey Sports Betting Insider Nick Costos. Insider calls are presented by BetMGM. Go check out all the latest lines today on the BetMGM app. Also, be sure to listen to You Better You Bet, the podcast, for more analysis. Just search You Better You Bet wherever you get your podcasts. And Nick joins us now in the Aturo Tire Hotline. Aturo, your hometown tire, Aturo.com. Nick, good morning. How are you?
What's going on, guys? How are we doing today?
Doing well.
Yeah, we're having fun.
Absolutely. And ahead of a great sports weekend, absolutely love it. Maybe the Bears can get off the schneid offensively at the Indianapolis Colts.
Well, let's not get carried away. You know, let's see. They are not favored in that game. It's kind of surprising because the Colts are 0-2 playing at home. Nick, explain that one to me and what you expect Sunday in Indy.
Well, I think, you know, Indy is like a 1-point favorite in the game. And Indy, think about the dome they play in, right? A really good home field advantage. This tells you that I think the betting market is valuing on a neutral field that the Bears are actually better than Indianapolis, given that Indy is only a 1-point favorite in this game. Now, coming into the year, I tried to say, and things can change. I think Caleb Williams is going to be awesome. I think this team will be cooking with gas at some point. I don't like this head coach. I don't like Matt Eberflus. I think the offensive coordinator, Shane Waldron's a total disaster. And Caleb Williams has not looked good through the first two games of the season. Now, if you wanted to have some optimism about the Bears this weekend, you would look at how poorly this Indianapolis Colts defense has played, most notably last week when the Green Bay Packers ran all over them with Malik Willis at quarterback. Now, I know this because I have DeAndre Swift on like 8 fantasy teams. He's been DeAndre Slow to start the season. But if there were ever a matchup where DeAndre Swift should get off the schneid, Colts run defense brutal. DeForest Buckner, their best defensive lineman, on IR, he will not play in this game. It should be a nice game running the football for DeAndre Swift. Now, the problem that I have with getting to betting the Bears in this game is the difference on the two sidelines. Like, pick the winner of the game, Matt Eberflus or Shane Steichen. I'll roll the dice with Shane Steichen and the upside of Anthony Richardson here. So I do like the Colts in the game a little bit. I'll also say the total is 43.5. And one thing you can say, even if you don't like Shane Waldron, and I don't, and we know Shane Steichen does this also, both teams play really fast, really up-tempo. Bears run a ton of plays. Colts run a ton of plays. I do think we see the over in this game, currently below one of the key numbers of 44. So I like the over 43.5. Make me pick the winner. I'll take Indianapolis. Sorry, Chicago.
DeAndre Slow, do you hate Swift too?
No, I'm a Swifty in some regards, but not in this one here with the Bears running back.
I got to tell you, I think that the Bears need to kind of operate under center. I got a lot of thoughts of how they could improve their running game and improve the protection for the quarterback, etc.
Yeah, get some better offensive linemen would be my suggestion.
Yeah, but I think the time to do that is in the offseason. I'm not sure you can do that now, Nick. Do you know of whether or not they can make multiple trades for good offensive linemen? Are teams trying to get rid of guys?
I would say that if teams have good offensive linemen at this point, I think they'd probably like to hold on to them. And look, I think this is going to be like a season where the Bears finish under 500. I'm not trying to be negative. Again, you have the franchise quarterback. I think they're going to be awesome in the future. But you need, I'm sorry, you got to have a better head coach, and we need a better offensive coordinator for Caleb Williams. I don't think it's happening this year. I could be wrong, but I think I'm right.
Oh, Prop King, what sayeth you?
All right, so let's go to, I love that. What? Let's go to tonight. Patriots and the Jets. Thursday night football. It could be a snoozer 20 minutes from where I live in MetLife Stadium. The player that I think is really interesting in this game, at least in the anytime touchdown market, is Patriots tight end Hunter Henry, who is being priced right now. I have BetMGM up. Hunter Henry is plus 450 to score a touchdown in this game. Henry, the 12 targets last week, he is being used a ton in this passing game by offensive coordinator Alex Van Pelt in the New England Patriots. And we think C.J. Mosley, one of the Jets' outstanding linebackers, he's questionable for this game, hasn't practiced this week. If he misses this game, I think the Hunter Henry touchdown price is mispriced here. So how about a prop for tonight? Hunter Henry anytime touchdown tonight for the New England Patriots.
What is your best bet of the weekend, Nick?
Oh, I'll give you one in college, and then I'll give you one in the NFL. In college, you want to get a 7.5 here. It's been 7.5 throughout the week. We're basically hanging out in between 7 and 7.5 in the betting market. Oklahoma is a 7.5 point home underdog against Tennessee. And for people that don't know, Tennessee's quarterback, Nico Iamalava, is going to be the number one pick in the NFL draft. I don't think he's eligible for another two seasons, but he's unreal. He's likely to be the number. So just remember that name. Nico from Tennessee is probably going to be the number one pick in the draft in a couple years, putting up video game numbers, one of the Heisman favorites right now. I think, though, the betting market has gone a little too far here with Tennessee. Oklahoma, in its first game in the SEC, playing at home here with a good defensive head coach in Brent Venables, getting a touchdown or more. I will take the points coming up with Oklahoma, so give me Oklahoma. And then on Sunday, how about, Bears fans will like this one, how about the Houston Texans basically in a coin flip game on the road in Minnesota against the Vikings? Houston's about a 1.5 point road favorite. When it comes down to it, we can simplify it like I did Steichen or Eberflus, like Stroud or Darnold in a pick'em game. I'll take C.J. Stroud. Give me the Houston Texans to win on the road in Minnesota.
Great stuff, Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
You got it. Wishing you guys and all your listeners minimal sweats winning bets. The absolute very best of luck.
That was the host of You Better You Bet and Odyssey Sports Betting Insider, Nick Costos. Insider calls are presented by BetMGM. Go check out all the latest lines today on the BetMGM app. We're going to bring in Brian Baldinger next. We'll talk some football, NFL football, and some Bears football. Both things. Both the NFL.
Baldy's breakdown.
And then the Bears. Because they're kind of, hey.
Come on.
Get your act together, Mulligan. Mully and Haw on the score.